Thank you very much, Carl. Ladies and gentlemen, we do not have much time for questions, and there are a lot to be asked, a lot of things to wonder about. But get texting, or I'll be onto the floor quickly, catch my eye, and we'll get a microphone to you, one or the other. Just to start with, Andy Pittman, knowing what you know, knowing what you told us, when you hear the rest of this discussion about how we cope with what we already know, with what's already happened and what's coming, what do you feel about it?
So I think the insurance industry is probably the leading industry in terms of adaptation to climate change. It's well positioned and it understands a lot of the issues. Ultimately, though, you won't be able to adapt to climate change. If we don't mitigate emissions, in the end, it will break the system. So adaptation is very important. It's very important over the next 20 to 30 years, but ultimately you've got to cut the emissions.
But you're encouraged by what you hear, but does it begin to go far enough?
No, I think the insurance industry is very good at helping build resilience and drive adaptation, but ultimately we have to cut emissions, and I am not particularly encouraged by what's happening globally to cut emissions. There has been hints of progress in the last 72 hours, but as I said, I'm not overly confident that we'll actually do it.
Well, that was one of my next questions to you, and that is, for all the headlines that the US-China deal got at APEC in Beijing, did it add up to anything?
So, at the moment, as far as I understand it, all of the things you're hearing about will reduce the rate of increase, not turn that around to a decrease. So we are slowing the rate of increase, which is a good thing, but we actually have to turn emissions down to zero fairly quickly. And I don't see any evidence of the global community being mature enough to address that issue yet.
A question from the floor that's come in, texted in. The insurance industry used to be a leader in climate change discussions, but recently seems reluctant to use the CC words. Does the industry and associated professionals need to do more? Carl, I suppose you're here with the industry hat.
Sure. I guess I'd, in looking at that question, I reflect on when I came to the industry about a decade ago, there were a lot of people that I met that had climate change in their title. And now I wouldn't be able to find any at all. It used to be part of the Insurance Council's blueprints and mantra, one of our major activities. But there was a subtle shift away from that about the time that it started to become so politicised. And the industry started to shift towards a focus on extremes and extreme weather. So obviously closely related to climate and climate change, but very much a focus on affordability and what's driving those losses right now. So I think the industry can certainly do more around climate change, but of course our focus is on what's going to happen in the next 12 months out to 3 years, and then, you know, for your investment planners and others, what's going to happen over the next 10 years or so. And we do have a longer focal lens on those development control decisions that might lead to poor extreme weather outcomes down the track. So, look, I'd agree with the premise that we can do more around climate change as an industry to have a voice on it, but the thing that lets it down, and I imagine it's like many parts of the community, is the politicisation of particularly carbon reduction is very unfortunate, because it's got in the way of an honest debate and honest policy changes.
What follows there is a challenge to the industry. All the phrases that come to mind are somewhat sexist. To grow a pair, to man up.
I don't know what you mean. But,
Is it a challenge to the industry?
Yeah, absolutely.
To take on the politics.
Yeah, and there are individual market players who are doing that. With a strong focus on that, and I think that's how you see any industry start to change. In the same way that not all insurers left the market for Roma and Emerald and those locations, it only takes one or two large insurers to step into that space, and they can make a very, very significant change using their market power. We do get asked to do some strange things for climate change, though. We've been approached many times by stakeholder groups asking us to not give insurance to people who produce CO2. Any cars over certain emission levels, we should stop insuring them. So the debate gets very polarised very quickly, and insurers are trying to sell product to people in the middle of that debate with a reasonable price signal around it. So, yes, we can do more, and I think you'll see some larger insurers who are more sophisticated start to do more.
This question for Ty. Look, just in case we haven't become depressed enough by what we've heard, aside from cyclones, floods and earthquakes, are there other perils that we haven't considered, just before we take some more questions?
No, again, if you look at property versus non-property, I think some of the non-property perils, if we're talking about insuring tomorrow's risk, we're talking about cyber and technological risks and that sort of thing. But if you stay on the property, which the session's been about, I think it's magnitudes and I think it's relativities. And I think if you, you know, like you're saying, the earthquake risk is reasonably constant, difficult to measure. It's those growing risks with the climate change. But I think it's overlaid, and you saw the Swiss Re slide, it's overlaid with just building in exactly the wrong spots for exactly the wrong reasons. And we can sit here and talk about, you know, things around the edge of the Brisbane River, but compared to some of the Chinese cities, compared to Manila, compared to Jakarta, where the buildings are going in these places is just deeply concerning. And as these, you know, so you've got the economic growth, the growth in wealth, the growth in insurance, the location, overlay climate change, I think it's just going to be the same peril, it's just bigger and bigger.
So,
yeah.
So whatever you thought about local insurance companies, the global reinsurers, don't touch them. No, that's an economic message that I wouldn't be making. Frankie, there's a question that's come through text that retrofitting existing properties to current building codes will go some way towards addressing the affordability issue in North Queensland, or FNQ as we used to call it in my day. It's a great branding. What resilience work has been done by the Queensland QRA in FNQ?
Well, look, the QRA wanted to share more information with the public, and one of those was storm surge. One of those was actually moving things to a more resilient state. One of the things we saw in 2011 was the electric switch box was actually at a very low level. One of the things in the building industry was actually to put that back up to a higher level, so when a flood actually does come in. Unfortunately, there is only a limited amount that you can do to retrofit all those old buildings. One of the things that the Queensland government's been doing successfully is to try and build levies, but yet again, it's making sure you get your best bang for your buck. We've talked about affordability. And really, at the end of the day, we've seen levies built in Charleville, in Rome and St. George. Rockhampton's another one been released recently.
There is a question down back. Sound of mic, please. Thank you. While I'm on the way, got my first front page lead as a cadet reporter was the 74 floods in Brisbane. I don't remember, the community recovery centres. Are people softer these days? What expectations have changed? Are there too many Victorians living in Queensland who can't handle disasters?
I'd like to answer that, Michael, but I'm an Irishman, so I'm
therefore you're safely neutral. Question from the floor.
Thank you. Elaine Collins. It's for Frankie. Frankie, reconstruction after disasters is obviously vitally important, and your group seems to be doing a wonderful job at that, and that's obviously on both infrastructure and houses. My question is there any danger of discouraging people to buy insurance for their house because they have to pay a premium every year and some of it might be premiums might be going up, where they think that they will actually get reconstructed by your group instead of the insurer?
Yeah, thank you. Good question. Look, the Queensland government after the 2011 floods had a more proactive role in that reconstruction, especially those lower socioeconomic groups. In 2013, they did not actually step into that space at all. It was actually done by a community group in Bundaberg, took that up. So there has been a step back from that to try and make sure that balance is actually kept properly.
Carl? Productivity Commission was mentioned several times. APRA wasn't mentioned once. I would have thought APRA had something to do with the insurance industry. Is it saying anything? Is it doing anything? Is there a feel from APRA about some of the issues that might impact upon insurance companies?
I certainly can't speak on behalf of APRA, and I presume they've presented it at one of the other sessions, but Look, APRA have a very strong focus on the prudential regulation, and they don't tend to step outside of that with commentary that doesn't relate specifically to maintaining that system and scheme. Some of the more awkward interventionist policies that the current government is coming up with in terms of the insurance market might directly impact on the prudential stability of some of those players in the market. So, for example, an unauthorised foreign insurer operating here and selling policies in far north Queensland at a you know, drastically reduced rate is not subject to any APRA regulation. And there are all kinds of disclosure issues, dispute resolution issues. It goes on and on and on. So APRA's in an awkward position there. They've actually got no role and responsibility to manage that situation. But they certainly, I imagine, would not want to see insurers let off the hook in terms of, you know, in certain circumstances being able to reduce their prudential compliance and capital holding requirements. So I think that's a question for APRA. They have a very, very clear mandate and role in Australia, and you'd argue they've done it very, very well. We have an incredibly stable insurance industry. The offset to that is, or the downside to that is, it's expensive to operate here as an insurer. But I don't think we weaken one to achieve a lessening of the price signal.
Yeah, just, the APRA bit's interesting because the APRA test is really around the 1 in 200 probability over a 12-month period.
Mm.
So if you take that, this stuff goes beyond that 12-month period, beyond the solvency. I think the interesting bit with APRA is, and you know, if you look at what they do on the banking side and look at what they do with the cap modelling, is some of the stress testing. And so, you know, and coming back to Andy with the extremes, is, you know, APRA is more taking a stress approach, not necessarily linked to climate change, but looks at the stress test. But then the actual capital thing is a 12-month period, but modelling beyond 12 months for an insurance company is pretty challenging.
Mm.
Number four.
Rosie Wynn, you've talked predominantly about the impact of climate change on property classes. I'm wondering whether with the science becoming so strong, we're likely to see any liability type claims emerging, either for government not taking action where things are foreseeable or against polluters. Have any of the panel seen any claims of that type sort of emerging or those types of risks or got any thoughts they'd like to share? Thank you.
I'm happy to kick off there. We certainly are seeing a lot of... I'm not seeing much in the way of claims. Others may have seen that. But we're certainly seeing a change in the posture of decision-makers who might need to make a decision now that they know in the future could look like quite a bad decision looking backwards, you know, with the value of hindsight. So we're seeing them ask those questions. We're seeing them refine their product requirements to protect them, and typically it relies on if they've made a decision with the best available information and in good faith, then they're typically going to be indemnified going forward. And I would see that would start to broaden out across all industries. And, you know, we've got dust diseases to really thank for that kind of thinking and legislation that backs that sort of thing up. So it's definitely on people's agendas, particularly for town planners and local governments making these decisions where they are very cognizant of the fact that they might be called to account, God forbid, in a Royal Commission or a Coroner's Court 20 or 30 years down the track when something's gone horribly wrong that may have been foreseeable but hopefully wasn't.
Look, I want to get about 50 more questions in and we haven't got time for it, but let me try to merge a couple of questions that have come through. There is a question that raises the issue of cross-subsidies. Some view the price signal as sacrosanct. Actually, no, not in carbon. We don't believe in the price signal on carbon in this country anymore. But are there instances of cross-subsidy that are accepted? Is there something to happen there in the industry? Or that importance of the price signal, is that something the industry, and perhaps to get a political message over as well, has to be kept?
Is that the question?
The question.
I think cross-subsidies are applied in some markets, and they could certainly be applied in general insurance for the property market. The question is, how do you communicate that somebody's getting a cross-subsidy, the benefit from it, and who pays? So, the Natural Disaster Insurance Review that went through, Mr. Trowbridge's solution for a pool, if implemented, every aspect of it would have been a very good solution. The problem is what I was saying before, practicalities and political expediency. You can bet that only certain things are cherry-picked, and what you end up with is an awkward cross-subsidy system where people with no buy-in to the risk or risk mitigation end up paying to lower the price signal for those at high risk. We did a lot of testing in 2012 around the consumer sentiment around how much extra would they be willing to pay being in a low-risk zone for somebody in a high-risk zone. And it was quite shocking, visceral, even, the change. People are not willing to pay for other people's risks. So if you're going to do cross-subsidies, it has to be engineered in a way that the people or the body or the agency responsible for managing that risk are the ones that pay the cross-subsidy, and in doing so are motivated to get rid of that risk down to the point where it's not an issue anymore. Very difficult to do. That's why we don't have one, and I'd suggest why we're probably not going to see one.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think the biggest challenge you've got is, in an ideal world, you wouldn't need it. The problem is where some of this stuff's built. Mm. You know, and I think that was where some of the pooling stuff came about, was around that affordability issue. It's, in an ideal world, some of the houses wouldn't have been built in the last 50 years, and it's how do you manage that small sector. So the other bit too is if the overseas players come in and don't have the rating sophistication, they're going to have accidental cross-subsidies and they're going to get picked off.
And Andy, as a climate scientist, when issues such as price signals come up, is that something that you're happy to stay away from because you've got more than enough bushfires to put out?
I learnt a long time ago not to tell industries how to play their games. I don't understand pricing and the like. I stick to the physics. Thank you very much.
What does the Insurance Council think should happen to the people within 7%? Sorry, happen to... I'm trying to understand this one. The 7% of people who cannot afford flood insurance and where there is no flood levy solution, should the government help them? I think it's a continuation of the same question.
Yes, I think it's perhaps slightly misconceived. The 7% is commonly the figure we use in Australia for the number of addresses or the percentage of addresses with some level of flood risk, all the way out to probable maximum flood. If we look at the segment that has the extreme level of flood risk, which we might say is the 1 in 20 year or 5% AEP, it gets down to sort of about 0.5% of addresses. That's still an enormous number of addresses, but I'm using addresses very, very carefully here, not properties, not buildings, because when you actually look at those addresses, the vast majority of them are vacant blocks of land. Why? Because the local government says you can't build there unless you're going to build 18 feet in the air because you've got a flood risk. So it's kind of a self-correcting situation there. However, there are a minority of people with an extreme flood risk or extreme cyclone risk or other risk that largely makes their options for insurance cover quite expensive indeed. Now, what should we do about that? Well, you could consider a cross-subsidy scheme that helps them out. You could also consider that everything in life has a life cycle. Hakuna Matata. At some point, property becomes too old to maintain, too old to do something with, or in this case, too risky to insure. So grandfathering and assistance can be applied for a short amount of time, but at the point where that property needs to be sold or needs to be redeveloped, that's when the government needs to impart some fairly strict controls around how it should be redeveloped, if it should be redeveloped, or in fact if it should be taken back to the Crown.
There are some houses that could deal with blowing away.
Absolutely.
Oh, he's cruel. Who said that? Look, I'm over time. I want to squeeze in two more questions. The 74 floods in Brisbane, I remember them well. And after the 74 floods, turns out there were flood maps that were already there and were just ignored all over the place. And then it turned out that they were still ignored. Are they still being ignored in Brisbane?
Very funny story. I arrived in Brisbane about 10 years ago, and my father-in-law said to me, who'd lived in Brisbane all his life, buy a house above the railway line, because the railway line was built after the 74 floods to actually allow access in. Unfortunately, we have very short memories, and we forget very quickly. And house prices in those flood areas have started to increase again because there's shortage of supply. So demand outstrips the supply. People will still go back and live there.
I suppose it's standard procedure in a real estate ad, for particularly for strata blocks, that you put down the quarterly strata dues and the rates. Maybe there's a requirement to put down the insurance premiums for a block. Just a thought. Andy, I want to give you the last word. There was a very broad question came from the audience before, and that was, what does it say about our species? Is there any optimism you can give us?
Well, I actually do have an answer to that, and it may not be very popular with the panel and a fair percentage of the audience. In reading literature on psychology, it seems to me that women are far better at assessing risk than men. Therefore, I reckon a big step forward would be to make sure there's equality on the boards, and that's why I was so delighted to see when the world leaders turned up to Brisbane, it was about gender balance, and as many women as men, not. And so the decisions around long-term risk aren't being made by a balance of the people who understand how to take that into account. So I would advocate gender balance on the boards of every Australian company and gender balance in world leadership of countries. And I reckon that's going to take a while. See? I said it wouldn't be popular around about 50% of the room. But next time you're in a board meeting, you watch. The women will do risk better than the men.
Well, fellas, aside from, you know, the sell signal on the insurance industry, turns out you should be somewhere else. This is
only half of them.
Only half of them. That will do. Ladies and gentlemen, look, there were more questions coming through, and, God, there are a lot of questions I would have liked to ask, but I've already gone over time with this exceptional panel. You have been frightened. You're meant to be frightened. There's stuff to be frightened of. But we also do have this wonderful ability as a species. However, of all the scary things I thought we heard, the scariest one did come from Andy, and that was just pointing out that 2% rise on average means 4% over land and 6 to 8% in extreme events. Please don't send any more Victorians to Queensland. The influx has been bad enough as it is, because I think Queensland's going to come through this just fine. We were tougher once. Ladies and gentlemen, please thank an exceptional panel.